Doran's larger than life on the screen here, ready to pop in.
All right.
I just had a question for Mr. Guevara. Being an educator in a formal sense and then also in a grassroots sense, do you find that, that this type of education that you've been doing, teaching people how to resist kind of mainstream ideas for the area, let's say sexual discrimination, do you find that's as effective as the formalized education that you also participate in?
I'm very sorry. I couldn't hear you very well. Okay. It's very low, your volume. So I more or less understand your question, but I'm not sure about the last two sentences. I couldn't catch it. Could you test your voice? Hello?
Can you pump it up, Alyssa?
Hello?
Pump up the voice? Yeah,
no, that's better. No, that's perfect. Yeah.
Well, my question was just if you found the formalized education as effective as the grassroots education that you've been taking part in, and when you've left or when you've done these types of activities and then left, have you felt that you've made a real impact in doing so, or like I'm curious to know your take on that kind of.
Yeah, impact on the people I interact with.
Yeah, or just. The method of delivery, I guess, for the ideas that you're trying to present. Do you find
okay? All right. So I think I use this same system in my classes. You know, even though I teach anthropology, I have a interdisciplinary kind of take in education. So what I do, I bring my experiences to the classroom, and then I contextualize them with a couple of theories that are kind of useful. For obviously, but you know, especially for seminars and 3,000, 2,000, I lecture a little bit and then I open it up for what do you think? So it comes from this notion of teaching comes from actually theater. Okay, I do it in a way of sharing, learning together. Okay, so it's kind of more democratic. I don't want you to see me. As the person with more knowledge, I want you to see me as somebody who's your friend, who's going to talk about with you, to you through my experience, and I want you to tell me your experience too, whatever that experience is.
Well, so, speaking of that, maybe we could quiz Doran a little bit on Ketimovic, which obviously is an agency devoted to a sort of education. A sort of education that has to do with hands-on, actually going out into communities, getting involved with issues, getting involved with people where they live, getting beyond the kind of thing we're doing here, which is talking about it in these matters in an abstract way, in a theoretical way, but combining this kind of education with hands-on, actually doing things. Mm-hmm. I don't know, could we draw you out a little on your experiences with Ketimovic? You've been in Canada World Youth too, Doran, have you? Which sort of flows out of Ketimovic. In my days, they called it the Council of Young Canadians. The Peace Corps was such an agency in the United States.
I can give you a quick rant about it if you want, but I guess like programs like Ketimovic in Canada World Youth use kind of this interactive kind of framework of education where throughout the week they have workshops within like a group setting in a kind of house setting and pretty much learn about what they want to learn about and then have people come in and teach about that kind of stuff. But then also throughout the week there's work placements where you can actually go and participate in various work projects that teach about you know, whatever you decide you want to learn about. So, I don't know. Like for me, for instance, I was working in an art gallery and a daycare center and places, a lot of places like that that I'd never gone before or worked before. So, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And also, since it's a group setting too, you get to learn about you get to exercise some of the activities that you learn as well. But it's just kind of like an alternative kind of education style as well. But yeah.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. So, you are participating and learning. So that's the idea, learning through participation. So this is the emphasis that I bring to my classes, especially the upper level classes. It's you learn through the process. But I don't know if I'm answering your question.
Nope, that's fine. That was you did already.
Perfect. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Any more questions?
I've got a couple comments. There's some nice things coming out of the text chat, and a couple of things I've noticed. One is the rollback on the text. It doesn't go very far. Oftentimes, in other social software, you can actually capture the entire text chat, and people have done, you know, text analysis to try and, you know, tease out interactivity and things like that. I was just
James,
wondering
when you say roll back on the text, I have no idea what you mean.
The texting line, the actual text itself as it appears on the screen, it doesn't go back to the beginning of the class, for example. There's a limit there, and I just was wondering if the Alberta server, like it's a VC Alberta chat, I wonder if they are collecting the data, because you know, sometimes you do text analysis to try tease out interactivity and things like that. Just something I noticed. Also,
is this a worry about Big Brother watching or something like that?
You never know. You know, we're talking about using it to advance the
academic freedom still
exists in Canada. Anyway. I want to make a reference, Umberto, to Paulo Freire.
Mm-hmm.
This guy, yes. Is a hero of mine in some ways, and
too.
It's a pedagogy of the oppressed here.
Mm-hmm.
And the way you're describing this situation, I just want to read a little piece here. very poignant, written 35 years ago, but it's here now for us. He says, he's talking about the way that the oppressors see the world, and he says the desire for conquest, or rather the necessity of conquest, is at all times present in anti-dialogical action. To this end, the oppressors attempt to destroy in the oppressed their quality as considerers of the world. This quality of as a considerer of the world, it's almost like you know, you're the fabric of your own essence as a human being. I mean, you come here and you need to consider the world. But anyway, that's me. He goes on, since the oppressors cannot totally achieve this destruction, they must mythicize the world in order to present for the consideration of the oppressed and subjugated, a world of deceit designed to increase their alienation and passivity. The oppressors develop a series of methods precluding any presentation of the world as a problem and showing it rather as a fixed entity, as something given, something to which people, as mere spectators, must adapt.
Very interesting. And yeah, and I was inspired by him, and Augusto Boal obviously is inspired by him, and that's the type of methodology being utilized. You know, this idea that the educator and the student have to come to reconcile, okay, in order to understand the world in which we live, because obviously the oppressor is always finding ways to create that distance.
Yeah, I want to take up a point that I raised a little earlier. I want to put it in the context of the reality that, you know, it's a global world. We're interconnected. So we're talking about a revolutionary environment in Nicaragua or a revolutionary environment in Nepal. What about the potential of a revolutionary environment or the existence of a revolutionary environment in Canada? The idea that we talk about these issues of oppression and resistance and the possibility of creating some kind of popular movement to create a more equitable, fair kind of world. And that, you know, this applies to our own society. It's all the action isn't somewhere else. We're in the midst of this all the time. The tactics of oppression, the Contras, you know, have a very unique place in history. I've got Mahmoud Mamdani's book. Wonder if I can just go in on it here.
That's all.
Yeah. Okay, good Muslim, bad Muslim. But essentially, he looks at the privatization of terrorism. During the Cold War, when the U.S. couldn't commit its own troops to these foreign situations, and they had to essentially use proxies. And the Contras were the classic proxies, but there was also similar proxies in Mozambique, in Angola, where the U.S. essentially paid agents to conduct their state terrorism, and in a sense contracted out terrorism, privatized terrorism. And our discussion the other day, you know, you talked in a, to me, very poignant terms about anything where the revolution was succeeding in schools, in healthcare, in seed banks. Any symbol of the success of the Sandinista revolution was a target.
Absolutely.
And so it's not just hitting military targets. It's creating random acts of violence,
not
terrorism.
Random, not random. They are kind of...
Or symbolic acts.
Yeah, symbolic acts.
But it is terrorism. It's blowing up things.
It's
murdering people who are not, you know, army people, teachers, or Mamdani's view is that this is part of the dilemma. This is part of what creates the danger of terrorism that we now have formalized in the form of a war on terror. Mm-hmm. How can you have a war on terror when war is terror? You know, but your own frontline observations of that kind of terror directed at your own people, your relatives, what was that like?
It was interesting because some of the first things that became the target of the counter-revolutionaries, and this could be, I never read the CIA manual, where, you know, psychological manual that they used to train counter-revolutionary movements in the world. But this is interesting because one of the first things they did was to target seed banks. Okay.
Seed banks.
Yeah. You know, the things that create dependency, okay, or independence in the country. So in Nicaragua, you were kind of collecting seeds from Mexico, things, you know, corn seeds, different seeds that are resistant to pesticides. Or to pests, and they don't need pesticide, for example. So they were collecting all these seeds, and that was one of the targets, okay? Another target was, as you were saying, schools, teachers that were teaching in the mountains, literacy campaigners, you know, people who were kind of bringing literacy to the countryside, health workers, anything that will create a sense that the revolution was succeeding. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that was a symbolic kind of strategy, and it didn't matter who was in between. It didn't matter who died. You know, if the people were at the medical center at that point, and if they were just there, they were not members of the Sandinista army, but they were, you know, also killed, innocent people, and this has been documented by a lot of scholars and filmmakers. And some of them Canadian. The World Stopped Watching by Peter Raymond, the filmmaker who also produced the film about Romeo
Dallaire.
Yeah. Exactly. So it has been documented. This is not, and it was systematic in that sense. It was a low-intensity war against the Sandinistas to create this effect, okay? The Sandinistas were not able to support the campaign in health, the campaign in education anymore, because it was too dangerous and the resources were being utilized to fight the war, to fight the contra war. So that was, in a sense, and I don't think I saw it as a terrorism at that point. Mm-hmm. Okay, I saw it as a total aggression, but an understandable one, because Nicaragua has been invaded several times, mm-hmm. okay, since the time of Sandino. Okay, so through the history of Latin America, United States had control and change regimes that they were not to their pleasing. Okay, so that was understandable through the history of Nicaragua, the history that we were relearning through the Sandinista mm-hmm. process. And this is one of the things that still stayed in Nicaragua, okay? The Sandinista revolution is no longer there, and it failed because of so many problems. And some of them is failures of men. There were problems with trying to solve the inequality between the sexes, the problem of machismo in Nicaragua, for example. That was something that the Sandinistas didn't see as a problem to be solved. And that undermined, in a sense, the Sandinista revolution in the end. Mm-hmm. So we didn't see it as an act of terrorism. We saw it as an act of aggression that was understandable. But looking from, retrospective, I can see that it has been happening throughout the world. Mm-hmm.
Well, then you think the power of an example that might lead away from the dominant economic regime centered in the United States, the power of an example that might show other ways of organizing human society. And I think this is the context in which the discussion on healthcare in Canada and Alberta belongs. Yes, there might be some profits to be made for U.S.-based insurance companies if we were to change the format of healthcare, to transform healthcare from its current status, which has evolved to the point where it's considered by many people to be a right. When we
not perfect, but
we think, what does it mean to be a Canadian? Well, we know that if we get sick and we're poor, we're still going to have access to health care. The transformation of health care from a right to a commodity. I think this can be seen.
It's not difficult to imagine in our new world.
Well, that this is an example that, yes, there might be some profits to be made mm-hmm. in Canada, but the real issue is that the Canadian system represents a model, an example that those in the United States might want to duplicate, or some in the United States.
I have a question for the people in the class. When you're watching the screen, when you see the picture of them looking at each other while they're talking, is that preferable, or would you prefer them facing the camera? And think of this as also being repeated on everybody's computer at home.
Well, right now we can't see
them. Right. So have an input.
I guess the camera.
They should at least be both visible if they're talking to each other.
Okay, both visible. And do you prefer them looking at each other or looking at the camera? Okay. Okay. I'm just thinking of it from
now. We can't hear there's a discussion. This is a classic thing, and we hear some
you hear only
muffled
me?
Voices in the background.
Yeah,
you have to double click your mic.
The button and then
who you're talking to. So if you're talking to the class, it would be great if you or both of you would look at the camera, because it's kind of disconcerting to have you two looking at each other and talking to each other when we're supposed to be part of the discussion.
All right. Sorry about that. But it's easier. All right.
Always. All right.
Is that consensus here?
Yeah?
Yeah? Okay. All the right. Class has consensus on at
all
least
right.
So objections.
Next time we can put a camera. We can put a camera in each other's forehead.
Yeah. There you go.
That will work. All right.
Yeah, it is important that we be conscious of how we use this interactivity and what are the protocols, what are the ways of using it, speaking digitally to one another.
Now, Tony, you've just switched from us only seeing Alberto, now we only see you.
Okay.
Is that a problem?
I think it's preferable to have it fairly zoomed in on both of you, and if you look at each other, fine. If you look at the camera, fine. But it's
all right.
At least as the conversation goes back and forth, if it's a discussion, everyone's visible.
All right. So you have any other question?
I'm actually interested in a little bit of history about the Sandinistas. I know a few things, and I've traveled through Latin America and Nicaragua as well. So if you could give us
Andy,
a little bit of background.
Double click.
Yeah, so where? How back? How far back do you want to go back? Like
far as is relevant, like, I guess.
70s, yeah, okay. Started, it was like a link. The Sandinistas started as a group of students, law students in León. Tomás Borges is one of the still surviving founders of the Frente Sandinista of Liberación Nacional. And so this is the 1960s, early 1960s. And they organized, obviously they were influenced by the Cuban Revolution. They were idealistic young students who decided to change the system, okay? They have been living under dictatorship for 30 years, 20 years plus. And also, they were students of the history of Nicaragua, okay? So they were anti-imperialists, they were nationalists, and they found inspiration in a hero, Augusto C. Sandino, who in the 1920s and early 30s had fought a successful war against the Marines in Nicaragua, the U.S. Marines who had invaded Nicaragua, okay? Because the Marines, the United States government in the 1920s, after the independence of Nicaragua, but especially in early 1900s, they were always interfering in the political happenings of the country. So if the liberals were in power and they didn't like them, they supported the conservatives. So it was back and forth between the conservatives and the liberals. At one point, Sandino was a liberal, and the conservatives were in power, and they were obviously... they were not for agrarian reform. They had some connections with the oligarchy and also with the Catholic hierarchy. And so the liberals wanted to change that that regime. And Sandino was one of the generals of the liberal kind of army. But then the liberals and the conservatives signed a pact. Okay, brokered by the United States. And in this pact, they say, we are not going to fight anymore. We're going to share the government. We're going to go back and forth. You govern for a few years. I govern for a few years. But Sandino said, no, I will continue to fight until the U.S. Marines leave Nicaragua, until we have land, okay, our peasants have land to produce food. And so the only thing maintaining the power in Nicaragua were the U.S. Marines, okay? And so the fight between Sandino and the Marines became case celebre around the world. Thousands of people came to Nicaragua, journalists, famous writers, to see how this Sandino guy with 100 men, some of them children, and some of them very old man, old men, could fight against one of the most powerful armies in the world. Okay, so he didn't win in the war, in a war sense, but he was one of the first ones who utilized guerrilla warfare. Okay, so he hit the United States, the Americans, and then they ran. They brought this type of guerrilla warfare that was developed, was one of the first one developed in the Americas. So he became a huge hero. But throughout the history of Nicaragua, during the Somoza dictatorship, he was assassinated after the Americans left and left a puppet regime, and the Somozas became de facto the powerful in Nicaragua. He was assassinated by, you know, they invited him to say that the everything was over, but they through treachery, basically. So he was killed. So throughout the history in the 1930s and 40s, all the books ignored that element of history in Nicaragua. So Sandino was, in the memory of many Nicaraguans, a bandito, okay? Somebody who went pillaging and killing innocent people, etc. So that in the mentality of a lot of people, he was just a bad person, okay? And it took these Sandinistas who started reading, who were exposed to the history that had been written, but was not in Nicaragua. He was buried somewhere. So they constructed this notion of a hero that fought against the Americans. So the Nicaraguan Revolution is anti-imperialist. Okay, mm-hmm. It sees the actual role of the United States in shaping the structures of inequality in Latin America, specifically in Nicaragua. Mm-hmm. And so they were very unsuccessful at the beginning. In the 1960s, they were wiped out. There were about 100, and they were wiped out to maybe 3 or 4. And so they started to create alternatives to educate, and through education, okay, to one person at a time, educating workers, educating living in the mountains, and educating them about the history of Nicaragua, about the role of the peasantry, about the role of the workers in changing this system. And that's how they became powerful and more powerful and more powerful, and they split in the 1970s, and in 1978 they organized themselves again into one bloc, and they took the pragmatic notion of incorporating the bourgeoisie that was against the Somoza regime as well, mm-hmm. into the struggle.
I think I could try some observations on that. Let's take the story back to the Monroe Doctrine. And I can't overemphasize the importance of the Monroe Doctrine. In 1823, M-O-N-R-O-E, James Monroe, the President of the United States, in 1823, declared that the United States would not tolerate any imperial power from Europe to mm-hmm. intervene in the affairs of the Western Hemisphere. The exception, of course, was Canada. Canada was part of the British Empire. The British Empire in those days was by far the most powerful polity in the world, so they couldn't mm-hmm. really tell the mm-hmm. British government what to do in the Western Hemisphere. But they made a stand, and this was after the War of 1812. The British had flirted with the idea of backing an Indian revolt, an Indian rebellion, an Indian freedom-fighting enterprise as a tactic to oppose the Western expansion of the United States. That didn't succeed. Tecumseh was killed in the War of 1812. So the United States ended up, in a sense, sanctioning a revolutionary movement, but a kind of revolutionary movement which was modeled after the U.S. Revolution that didn't have much role for Indians or for slaves. So Simon Bolivar, for instance, is sometimes referred to as the George Washington
of
Latin America. Mm-hmm. And as I see it, these are Ladino revolutions. Bolivar, I understand, came up with the word Hispanic. And, of course, Hispanic emphasizes the Iberian Peninsula, Spain. Mm-hmm. And so a Hispanic identity suggests Latin Americans, but oriented more towards the European heritage than towards the Indian heritage. Mm-hmm. And there is this kind of
a problem with the
spectrum or hierarchy in Latin America, with Indians at the bottom, mm-hmm. Ladinos at the top.
Revolutions have been made by basically white people. Successful revolutions in Latin America have been pushed organized by Ladinos, by people, so-called mestizos, but I mean, they use the indigenous populations to fight the wars. But there are some problems. You know, it's very interesting to talk about the Latin American context in terms of what's happening right now in Bolivia, the first indigenous government, you know, the first indigenous president in the history of Latin America.
Evo Morales.
Okay. Evo Morales. That is unprecedented. Okay. Why? Why do we think so? 60%, 65% of the Guatemalan population is indigenous, is Mayan. Why is it that they are not in power? Mm. Okay. So there's a structural notion there. There's a structural system in which the system itself has kept these lower class marginalized populations from power.
Ashley
is ready to go.
Yeah.
I just have a question. Wasn't there an indigenous leader in Ecuador, president of Ecuador, that just got thrown out, kicked out, or whatever? He was like a military official. Am I wrong?
Yes, he was actually he was very influential in the government, and he brought the indigenous population's support to this president. I don't remember who that is.
But there can be right-wing Indians.
Absolutely, but I mean that regime didn't last long at all. Okay, they were not in power actually. They were kind of brokers of power. Mm-hmm. The indigenous, they are strong in Ecuador. It's true, they are very strong. They have strong unions and organizations, but they are plagued with corruption and some other problems. They are manipulated in a sense.
There's much irony in much of this, in that. The School of the Americas is infamous. Many of the paramilitary squads, the death squads, had their education in School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia, where the curriculum was tactics of torture, of intimidation, of bribery, of assassination. This was the curriculum, and this school continues to operate. And this was all being done in the name of anti-communism.
And
the Monroe Doctrine. Oftentimes the paramilitaries, the most ruthless killing squads, can be Indian people, poor people, whose desperation leads them to...
Yeah, many reasons. They have internalized, the power structures of the oppressor. I mean, it's not because of they have used the system to upper mobility. For example, that's the only way to survive in certain situations is to become like them. So you can also you cannot blame the victim. Okay, so they are victims of the structure of violence in a sense. Okay, you victimize if you are victimized, you will victimize the people who are closer to you, and that's what we have seen in Guatemala, for example, where there is more death squads, you know, people who are Indians, killing Indians first. After the so-called violence ended, there's still more violence in these communities. Mm. Okay,
it reminds me of the phenomena where if children are violated, if children are raped or abused, sexually abused, oftentimes when those children become adults, they will duplicate the same tragic pattern.
Something about that could be said. But, it's part of the same structure, okay, that there is no room. We don't know what Morales can do in this sense. It will be interesting to see what Evo Morales can do. But now there is a structure there where he could really rely on. And it's a structure that is organized by Venezuela, Argentina, and Uruguay.
Of course, Hugo Chavez, some would say, is quite Indian in his ancestry. So the concept of Evo Morales as the first is you know, open to all kinds of debate, I suppose. But you know, the situation in Latin America now, where you have Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, who is openly embracing friendship with Fidel Castro, and openly identifies his appreciation and his
and also he's creating this system of exchange, you know, an alternative economy, where he's giving Castro oil, and Castro is giving him doctors.
And now
here we go. Here's Alberta's healthcare.
Yeah, we need some doctors from Cuba, maybe.
We got oil.
You have Evo Morales in Bolivia. You have a very left-wing regime in Ecuador. Mm-hmm. You have a very left-wing regime, a socialist regime, although some would say he's betraying that tradition, Lula in Brazil. It's almost as if...
In Chile.
And Chile now.
We don't know.
What's interesting
what's happening there, which is interesting, is that they are creating an alternative, not only an economic alternative. There is a plan to create a Latin American bank, where Latin American countries will go and borrow money there. They don't have to go to the International Monetary Fund, which objectives are contrary to the objectives of development in Latin America, for example.
It's almost as if the United States, by trying to extend its empire into the Middle East or into Eurasia, into Afghanistan, into Iraq, into all the countries, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, all of these countries around the Caspian Sea. It's almost as if their traditional base, the traditional base of their empire, which is Latin America, they're losing control of it.
Absolutely. I don't know what's the next step the United States is going to take, because they have already, diplomatically, they have already denounced Chavez, for example, as a problem for the region, as a problem for democracy. Cuba, Uruguay, and Venezuela are doing is, and also Brazil to a certain point, is they created Telesur, which is like CNN, but with the perspective of Latin America. So it's like Al Jazeera for Latin America, where and it's 24 hours a day, it's funded by oil, obviously, from Venezuela, and they have correspondents everywhere in Latin America, so you can hear a voice that is Latin American for the first time, okay? A voice that talks about, it's not CNN going there sending the people to look at what's happening there, but it's Latin Americans themselves talking about their problematic. Another thing that they're doing is, as I said, is the bank, and they are creating, obviously, Mercosur, a kind of free trade of the Americas, but, you know, in a system where it's going to be equitable, where you're going to be able to share resources, as opposed to continue with the, you know, ruthless capitalism of destabilizing countries through debt.